happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share. If you would like to have an alternative to Viagra, I'm going to share one. If you want to protect yourself against radiation and cancer and hypertension, I'll show you a soup that can do it. If you want to know why you can protect your body and your brain from Alzheimer's, I'll tell you what to do, why to do it, and it's easy. Also, there's a way to turn off inflammation, and I'll give you that as well. So, in other words, everything involving how we can improve our body, our brain, our mood, right here on this program, and all of it from cutting-edge science and peer-reviewed literature cited in every program. A special hello to all the new listeners. I'm on the road now, and I received this morning from our program director, Jason, that we just passed a milestone. We're the only radio program in the world to pass 5 million over the telephone. By the way, let me give you that phone number, because if you're anywhere and you can't reach a radio station or you can't reach your internet, just pick up the phone and dial this number and you can hear the show. You can go to the archives. You can put it on speaker. And if you're driving a cab, or a lot of people are doing that right now, or a truck, that number, 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. In any case, I'm very pleased about that, plus the over 1.8 million new listeners that have come on board in the last 12 months. You can listen any way you want. We got plenty of ways. Today, my guest in the second part of our program is a pushback to Bill O'Reilly and the neocons that say that America's intervention in all things foreign, including Iran, was a good thing, the right thing. But they assume that we will not understand true history. Today from Germany, an investigative journalist, an Iranian historian and human rights and women's activist, whose father was the mayor of Tehran. And he was a member of the ruling National Front Party, and he was also the personal attorney and close friend to the first democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was deposed by a CIA and a British coup. That's right. How do we know? Well, this week, the CIA declassified documents proving the U.S. spearheaded the 1953 Iranian coup to depose the democratic government of Mossadegh. So who was this man? He stood for such strong principles. And why did he have to go? What became of the democratic movement? And why should we know all this in order to understand how to deal with Iran today? Also today, I want to talk about, dear doctor, do you really know what vaccines contain? From Sandy Luno. Also, fracking economics, the science and economics of fracking, companies that make money by keeping Americans terrified of terror attacks, and this is pure fascism. Verizon was given a $10 billion contract after records were released against the law to the National Security Agency. They got their payback. Remember, fascism is members of government working with private interests in the business community for their interests, not the public's. As you see, we have a lot to share on issues that count. Let's begin. Miso, M-I-S-O, is a paste. Now, you can have miso from barley, brown rice, soy, chickpeas, and it is a fermentation. It's rich in probiotics. It's one of the most healthy things we can consume. New research shows that it protects against radiation, cancer, and hypertension. From Margie King from Green Med Info, quote, "When the second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki on August 9, 1945, 21 healthcare workers were attending 70 tuberculosis patients in a hospital, just 1.4 kilometers from ground zero. None of them suffered from acute radiation poisoning. A doctor, Exukti, a physician at the hospital, credited this miracle to the fact that everyone was consuming daily cups of miso garnished with wakame seaweed. In a new comprehensive review of both epidemiological and experimental studies, Japanese researchers at Hirohitsu Research Institute, the Institute for Radiation Biology and Medicine at the university, confirmed the power of miso to prevent radiation injury. His review also documents the ability of miso to prevent many forms of colon, liver, breast, lung, stomach cancers, as well as hypertension. Now, miso is a staple of the Japanese diet. There, it's mainly from soybeans. They're fermented with sea salt, koji, which is a mold starter, and sometimes rice or oats. And the mixture is fermented for 3 months to 3 years. Now, the resulting enzyme-rich paste contains an enormous amount of plant proteins and microorganisms. But fermented foods are more than the sum of their ingredients. Fermentation gives rise to compounds that have amazing healing properties. Fermented foods like kimchi, natto, apple cider vinegar, even wine and beer have been called medicinal foods. His review of the science emphasized the importance of traditional fermented foods like miso to prevent disease and maintaining health. And his work on radiation is particularly good. And so my suggestion is that we start to include more miso. You can do it as a nice hot soup. What I do is simple. I take 1 tablespoon of miso paste. I put it in some warm water. Doesn't even have to boil. I then dice up some shiitake mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, garlic and onion, shallots, and I mix all that together. And then I let it steep at a warm temperature for about 15-20 minutes. And then you consume it. You could also add seaweed in there as well. Now that's a powerful preventative. Miso also helps prevent breast cancer. One epidemiological study showed that consuming a cup of miso 3 times a day reduced the occurrence of breast cancer. And so I would definitely consider using miso more often than what we do in our society. So it's all good bacteria, but it also helps lower your blood pressure, and that's good as well. In the very near future, in about a month and a half from now, I'll begin a one-month program of working with some people who have very serious medical conditions and try through a combination of lifestyle behavior modification and holistic medical intervention that within 1 month to substantially improve their conditions. This will be fully documented and filmed. It is my hope that with the type of conditions that will be addressed, that this should be able to give encouragement to those people or their family members that there is some hope beyond the orthodox model. All the people who will be attending have already tried everything within orthodox medicine. None are coming as neophytes. None are coming as first time they're being helped with this. One of the many different changes will be in getting people off coffee and commercial teas and caffeine, and getting them detoxified. In a controlled environment, you can do that. One of the ingredients that will be used on a rather substantial basis will be resveratrol, but also the catechins from green, red, oolong, and black teas, caffeine-free. Here's the latest of why I would select those particular ingredients. This is from the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom. This was published in the respected peer-reviewed journal of Biological Chemistry. This is from a Dr. Joe Rushworth. Quote, "We wanted to investigate whether the precise shape of the amyloid balls is essential for them to attach to prion receptors like the way a baseball fits snugly into the glove. And when we added the extracts from red wine, which is resveratrol, and green tea, which recent research has shown to reshape amyloid proteins, the amyloid balls no longer harm the nerve cells." Let me repeat that. The amyloid, that's plaque, in your brain, no longer harm the nerve cells. Researchers determined that the bioactive compounds in green tea and red wine, resveratrol, distorted the shape of the amyloid, preventing them from binding to prions and disrupting cellular function. And then, of course, when you look at curcuminoids from the spice turmeric, they cross the delicate blood-brain barrier, and that halts the advancement of dementia. So I'm very optimistic that those with Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's will find the relief that they deserve. And doing it with enough people and having the good medical documentation will at least open the minds of those who, not the mainstream, because they have hundreds of billions of dollars riding on their drugs, they're less interested in curing people than they are in profiting from the effort. And that's the way most medicine, unfortunately, works, though individual physicians are certainly more noble and more altruistic, but the system itself is warped and perverse. Now, we all are exposed to inflammatory agents every day. Normal living produces oxidative stress. So to limit that oxidative stress, we need antioxidants. We need to protect ourselves. The more antioxidants we have, the greater the protection. This is the latest study from the University of California, published in the peer-reviewed journal Food and Nutrition. Here's what it is. They looked at the diet high in processed foods, the average American diet, you know, all the sugar, refined carbohydrate, the grilled meats and hamburgers and deep fried food. Now, all of that releases the protein interleukin-6. Researchers use measurements of interleukin-6 to determine systemic inflammation throughout your body and have determined it's an effective gauge to assess the risk of developing many chronic illnesses, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, dementia, and metabolic syndrome. So then they wanted to see what could be done that could interfere with this process. So what did they choose? Fresh avocado with a burger. Now, we know the burger in and of itself is pro-inflammatory. It's really cancer-causing. It's bad. But the avocados made a difference. And they found that the fats in avocado, in clinical studies, are very good at lowering inflammation in the body. So here's the deal. These were young men, 18 to 35. So if they ate their grilled meats with avocados, the avocados blunted the systemic inflammation response and hence slashed the risk of disease. So the men received a hamburger with no avocado, and the blood levels of the interleukin-6 were sampled 4 hours after eating, and they found that there was a significant increase in the inflammatory protein by 70%. And that's just about what your body would find if you were fighting a bacterial viral pathogen. But interleukin-6 typically drops in a healthy person as the infection is controlled. So when the men were fed the same hamburger meal, along with one half an avocado, the interleukin-6 levels were controlled at 40%, and the triglyceride levels were not raised at all. Now, this is important, as just so you understand it. Triglycerides are directly associated with an increased risk of arterial plaque and associated with cardiovascular disease and heart attack risk. The higher triglycerides, the more likely you are to have a heart attack. So scientists found that measures of peripheral blood flow were reduced 27% after eating the burger alone, yet were not reduced when they were eating an avocado. Quote from Dr. David Heber, the lead scientist in this study. This study supports the hypothesis that fresh avocado may help support normal vascular function, which is important for heart health. Some of the after-meal effects observed after eating the plain burger, specifically inflammation and narrowing blood vessels, were reduced within hours, and triglycerides did not increase beyond what was observed after eating the burger alone. This study supports a wealth of recent scientific publications demonstrating the importance of combining raw and lightly steamed vegetables with less healthy food choices. Now, why would I share this with you? Why do I consider this important? Well, there's this primary reason. I grew up in a family that never did anything in the way of food to their betterment. They ate what they were told was the right food to eat. And as a result, they all developed disease. They all smoked. It was very common in my house to find every ashtray overflowing, to find lots of grease on the plates, because my family would eat a steak that had about a half inch of fat around it, because, of course, fat does give flavor to a food. And Dad would put a lot of salt onto his steak and some kind of sauce. And then there would be the mashed potatoes with some gravy, which was just flour with blood in it. They coagulated it, kind of gross, but that's what they ate. And I was the strange one that had to eat the baked potatoes or yams, and with, generally more often than not, an overcooked vegetable. There were no such things as salads except for iceberg lettuce and a tasteless tomato, unless it was the summertime. And the last vestiges of the victory gardens were the little gardens that people put in their backyards after the Second World War. And so everybody had a garden. Everybody was, you know, growing something, and they were celebrating the end of the war and return of the soldiers and return to some normal home life. And that's when our generation, the baby boomers, were born. We were very gifted and blessed to have been born at that time, because we were at the end of a transitional stage. We were the last ones to understand what it was like for our parents and or grandparents to have gone through the Great Depression and the earlier vestiges of America's Industrial Revolution in the roaring 20s and the teens. That kind of sense of the Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, the last elements of exploring your environment, not having a security state, being able to do things as we chose. No kid was ever chaperoned when they were going out to play in the morning. They'd go out and they'd play, and they'd come back at lunch, and you know, they'd go back out and play again. They'd come back at dinner time. You know, that was the way it was, and that was healthy. And so we were very fortunate, I believe, to have had that experience. But we also had some things that were not good. We were not aware, nor would we have accepted, that we were being manipulated by special interests to tell us what to eat, what to drink, and what to smoke. And so it was very common to live with the idea that smoking was good for you. In fact, there were ads in the Journal of the American Medical Association, full-page ads, showing that Lucky Strikes was endorsed by 46,000 physicians because it soothed the throat. No, it didn't soothe the throat, but that's what people were believed. Edward Bernays, the master manipulator of the message, was able to work with industries and convince people that they needed to buy something with repetitive advertising, and indeed we did. Long-lasting radio shows, television shows, Ed Sullivan, Arthur Godfrey, Ted Mack Amateur Hour, all of these shows were successful because of the advertising. That's what kept you on the air. And you could listen with your eyes closed to a commercial, and the music stayed with you, and hence the product identification. We didn't have as many products, and we didn't have as many vehicles to expose us to as many messages. So therefore, the messages we did get were powerful messages. Today, we have about 100,000 messages per year that we're exposed to. So needless to say, the average person believes when they go out. And it doesn't matter whether they're a PhD from Harvard or whether they're, you know, a person who's just spent a whole day working at a job, goes out to celebrate the end of the day with their friends and want to have something to eat. More often than not today, they're going to go to a place to get a supersized meal. Even if they can afford smaller portions, we love the idea that we're getting a big serving of something. We don't question whether it's good or bad for us. We just question, do we like it? And I couldn't get my parents to stop eating anything that was bad for them, or drinking. Lots of coffee, lots of sugar. And everybody had to have dessert, generally a cake or pie with ice cream, after a meal. Even if you were stuffed, you had to have it. It was the tradition. It was the custom. So when my aunts were all overweight and had diabetes and high blood pressure, it was not considered a part of their diet that contributed to that. It was the fact that they were now 40. And what do you expect? You're 40 years old. So we lived with all these fatalistic notions that where you're getting older, you know, whatever happens, it's just meant to happen. Today, we know a lot better. We just don't act better. So I would rather see someone have an avocado with a burger than to do nothing because they are not going to make any changes whatsoever. So even if we can get them to take a good vitamin into a smoothie or something that we know is going to be good to their cells to protect them, better that than them to do nothing at all. Because very few people are going to make any major changes. That is what I have observed in all my years in this field. Very few people make major changes. So if we can make small, even incremental changes, or if we can even, if they're not willing to make any change, then we can just help protecting from themselves, I think we have a more responsibility to do that, because these people in a rational conversation are not going to listen to us. So give them avocado with their barbecue and their fried chicken and their burgers. You could be saving them from a heart attack or a stroke. I was asked recently in an airport by a woman who came over, and she had seen me in Atlanta, where I've been, I guess, about 32 separate specials over the last 15 years. I'll be back there in another few weeks with another special. And she said, I've seen you so many times, and I keep watching because I'm always learning. She said, but I tend to have headaches, and I take Tylenol, and I read something about Tylenol and how many people are hospitalized and how many people died. Is there any other alternative to that Tylenol? And I said, sure there are. So I thought, well, how many other people in the audience probably would like to have an alternative also? So here are the natural Tylenol alternatives. Ginger. That's one of the best things you can do. It is strongly anti-inflammatory. It relieves pain, including headache pain. The best way of taking it is not as a tea, but as a juice. Juice 1 inch of ginger. Curcumin. It is an extremely powerful herb. It comes from turmeric. It can help with osteoporosis at 200 milligrams. But if you want to reduce pain anywhere in your body, then I would suggest 2 to 3,000 milligrams. Then it is extremely beneficial. Boswellia, B-O-S-W-E-L-L-I-A. It's also called Indian frankincense, and it has anti-inflammatory properties. It's been used for thousands of years to turn off pain. It's mainly used for arthritis pain, but it can turn off other pain. Also, the K-laser. Now, laser therapy reduces pain and inflammation, and it speeds up tissue healing, and whether it's ligaments, muscles, even bones. It also increases oxygenation of the tissues, and so that's all good. And what is also called astaxanthin, A-S-T-A-X-A-N-T-H-I-N. It's an oil-soluble antioxidant. It's very powerful. And it's as powerful as the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. And you don't need much, 10 milligrams. And final, cetyl, C-E-T-Y-L, myristoylate, M-Y-R-I-S-T-O-L-E-A-T-E, or what is called CMO. It's an oil. You get it from fish. And it's known as the natural joint lubricant. It's strongly anti-inflammatory. And it also helps if you have ganglion cysts. So that can help you as well. So all that will help if you want an alternative to Tylenol. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the issues that can make a difference in our lives. It's always nice to know people are sharing the information with one another. Now I'm going to go through several different points of view that I think the mainstream media would never touch, because you open that door, you can't control what comes back through, the truth. This is from Sandy Lunoy from VAC Truth. It is entitled, and I'll post it today, "Dear Doctor, Do You Really Know What Vaccines Contain?" I'll quote this. "Doctor, you strongly recommend vaccines, so you surely should be able to tell us about the ingredients, right? No doubt you've studied the product information. We haven't, we're lay people. So what is your opinion about secret and unknown substances in vaccines? So I'm going to give you some questions, doctor. I want you to tell me just honestly, doctor, I don't know which secret substances are present in vaccines." Well, thank you, doctor, for your honest answer. You see, doctor, we understand that vaccine manufacturers are protected by trade secrets and are not obligated to reveal all the ingredients in vaccines, even to you and other doctors. But these secret substances are termed GRAS, short for generally recognized as safe. One of these is peanut oil. Quote, "The extract composition of vaccines cannot and will not be disclosed under an exemption that protects business information with the Access to Information Act in Canada and the Freedom of Information in the United States. Similarly, trade secrets are also exempt under the British Freedom of Information Act. Thus, the guidelines to label refined peanut oil, moral obligation to label peanut oil, are in conflict with laws protecting trade secrets. Full disclosure of excipients was not and continues not to be general practice in the United States or Canada," end quote. Doctor, I didn't know that. Doctor, do you find it acceptable that substances termed generally recognized as safe when injected may, in case of peanuts, actually cause anaphylactic shock, death, or lifelong allergies? Why do you not show professional pride and sincere care for your patients by insisting that the presence of these secret ingredients be revealed?" No response, dear doctor? Okay. "How much latex may be leached into vaccines?" Doctor, I don't know how much latex is present in vaccines. What do you think about these facts, doctor? According to WebMD, the United States, we have 1-5% of the population suffers from latex allergy. One credible reason is that millions of children are injected with fluids containing latex allergens over and over again in connection with vaccine schedules. The presence of latex allergens in vaccines is due to leaching into the fluids from syringe and tip caps, plungers, and multi-dose vial stoppers. Information can normally be found about which specific vaccines have latex in the packaging, but this is not dependable as manufacturers often change rubber stoppers. It's also impossible to know the amount of latex allergens which has leached into the vaccine fluids. Amounts may vary according to time and storage conditions. When you puncture rubber stoppers of vaccine vials in connection with dose withdrawals, won't there surely be many rubber particles released in the vaccine? Doctor, I don't know the extent of the rubber particles present. We never studied that. Well, we understand that the last doses in multi-dose vials contain the most particulates of rubber. You surely agree, doctor, that particles in injections may result in serious health consequences for patients. For instance, we contact the Food and Drug Administration to ask about quality control of vial stoppers. We receive this response, quote, "To the best of my knowledge, there's no specific requirement for the manufacturers to count and identify particles after vaccine stoppers are punctured," end quote. Doctor, can you guarantee that vaccines contain equal amounts of virus allergens? Doctor, I don't know the amounts of any virus allergen present in each dose. I don't think anyone does. True, doctor. No one knows this. Virus antigens and vaccines may be in the form of tiny particles invisible to the naked eye, which float in the vaccine fluid. Irrespective of the shaking technique of the person who administers the injection, and even if they measure the volume of fluid correctly from a multi-dose vial, it cannot be guaranteed that the correct strength or amount of virus antigen will be the same for each person in the vaccine line. Are you aware that the last doses in the multi-dose vials contain the most mercury? Doctor, I don't know how much mercury is in each dose. I don't think anybody does. Well, that is surely serious, doctor. Quote, "Thimerosal, mercury preservative, tends to settle in the vial. It is not shaken up before being drawn. The first dose will contain low concentrations of mercury, and the last dose will contain enormously high concentrations. If your baby is the unlucky one that gets the last dose, serious brain injury can result," end quote. Did you know that there can be microbial contamination rates of up to 27% in multi-dose vials like measles, mumps, rubella, and that this may result in serious health conditions for patients? Doctor, I don't know the extent of any microbial contamination. I wasn't aware that there would be microbial contamination. How's that possible? Well, doctor, each time a dose is withdrawn, there is a risk of microbial contamination of the vaccine, with the last doses being the most contaminated. Contamination comes from the air and surroundings, and it can be caused by the doctor or nurse who administers the vaccine. The more people who are present, the greater is the risk of contamination. Quote, "There is significant variation in user techniques associated with multiple dose vials, and faulty aseptic techniques is the primary cause of viral contamination. Studies have demonstrated that the bacterial contamination rates of multi-dose vaccines vary significantly. The contamination rate in published studies has been as high as 27%. The predominance of evidence that contaminated multi-dose vials have contributed significantly to morbidity and mortality must not be ignored," end quote. Doctor, what is your opinion about the presence of foreign DNA and prion proteins? Doctor, I don't know if the vaccine I recommend contains foreign DNA or prions. That's unfortunate, doctor. We do understand, because in fact, nobody can know this. Vaccines may contain foreign DNA from insect cells, yeast, mouse brains, tissue from pigs, guinea pigs, rabbits, dogs, calf lymph, hens, eggs, chick embryos, monkey kidneys, testicle cells, retinal cells, aborted human fetal tissue, and cancer cells. Vaccines may also contain prions. Some substances are unexpectedly discovered as analysis methods become more advanced. There are more examples, including the SV40 and the polio vaccine, suspected of causing millions of cancer cases, in pig DNA and the rotavirus, both discovered long after the vaccines had been marketed. The discovery by the independent expert of aluminum-bound recombinant human papillomavirus DNA in Gardasil has unknown consequences, which may be horrific. Doctor, are you also aware that the FDA has approved for trials the use of cell lines derived from human cancer tumors for vaccine manufacture? The meeting of the advisory committee is accessible to a webcast for several hours' duration. from viewing the last session, part three, it's understood that it may not be possible to guarantee that these vaccines will be free from of agents from the substrates, nor may they not induce cancer nor cancer tumors in the recipients. So, in conclusion, please note, Doctor, the committee suggested that to avoid public anxiety, the information about vaccine production from human cancer cells be omitted from package inserts. It was also decided that, not to panic the public, that a special committee meeting be held to discuss how to present the information to doctors concerning vaccine production from human cancer tumors so people could feel more comfortable about it. Doctor, you have confirmed that you do not know what vaccines contain when you administer them to your patients. The truth is that nobody knows, not even the manufacturer. Consequently, you will no doubt agree that you are unable to provide us with information about vaccines which is both relevant and adequate for us to be able to make an informed choice. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. And when students took the entrance exam for medical school, they were perplexed by this question. Quote, rearrange the letters P-N-E-S-I, P-N-E-S-I, to spell out the part of the human body that is most useful when erect. Those who spelled spine became doctors. The rest are in Congress. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting from our studios, and we're going to go in just about 1.5 minutes to Germany, where we'll be talking with Fariba Amini. And my guest, I gave you her background, as a journalist who writes on Iranian history and human and women's rights. Her father was the mayor of Tehran and a member of the ruling National Front Party and the personal attorney and close friend of the democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was deposed, according to the latest declassification of CIA documents, in 1953 in a coup. And why? And think of all the people who said, it never happened, we had nothing to do with it, and we need the Shah back, the neocons. We're going to address all those with her in a moment. Just two quick program announcements. I'm going to be hiring two new nutritionists, people who have a qualified background and state registration in dietetics and nutrition science, to help counsel people. We just have more people by the thousands who need help than the five I currently have can handle. And if you're qualified and would like to apply for a good-paying job, you'll call 646-926-5422 and ask to speak with the person there, and they will then follow up, and one of the people will do some interviews. Because we're starting a very busy time in another 3 weeks, And I want to be able to help as many people as possible. And all the help we give is free. There is no charge ever. We've helped probably 30,000 people for free, and we continue to do so with lifestyle and behavior modification. So anyhow, if you want to get one of those jobs, I'm going to be hiring two, and it's well-paying, you just call that number. And finally, before we go to our guest, no one else on this network, which is the number one internet network in the world, plus the land stations we're heard on, has to raise a penny. And that's because once in a while we offer a premium. All of that goes to support the station. And we do it with things that really make a difference in someone's life. Today it's the antioxidant called Super Antioxidant. It contains the antioxidants in the right amount, like vitamin A and C and E and B6 and magnesium, zinc, selenium, copper, astaxanthin, quercetin, L-carnosine, lycopene, rosemary, tocotrienols, raspberry leaf, citrus bioflavonoids, rutin, bilberry, fruit, red wine concentrate, green tea, 200 milligrams, glutathione, cysteine, coenzyme Q10, N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, superoxide dismutase, taurine, pycnogenol, broccoli, licorice, lutein, cabbage leaf, milk thistle, and bromelain. Those are all the best antioxidants, all in one synergistic vegan capsule. There's 90 capsules. It's called Super Antioxidant, and here is the deal. It's just this simple. You're going to get two of them. What a great special for the price of one. How do you get them? You just dial the number. If you don't have the number, let me give you the number that you can call in and get them. Again, and that's, this special is only for 24 hours, so please call and get them while we still have them. And that is, I believe that number is 877. What is the number here? I'm going to ask my engineer to give me 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. It's been out of stock for 4 months. It's back in. And I just thought, what a nice thing for people who care about their health to do something really good for themselves. I suggest 3 times a day that we give our body the antioxidants that can trap the free radicals that do so much good for us. And I know of no other antioxidant that is this comprehensive, synergistic, balanced, vegan. What a way to go. So give a call. Now let's go over and say hello in Germany to my guest who's standing by, Fariba. Am I pronouncing your last name right? Amini?
Yes, Amini.
Amini. A-M-I-N-I. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary. I'm very glad to be on your show.
I have a few quick thoughts. I would like to do a little bit of reading. One is from Robert Shear today from Truth Dig. I'll just read the first two paragraphs. Quote, 60 years ago this week, the United States, in collaboration with Britain, successfully staged a coup in Iran to overthrow the democratically elected Prime Minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, that a newly declassified CIA document reveals was designed to preserve the control of Western companies over Iran's rich oil fields. The U.S. government at the time of the coup easily had manipulated Western media into denigrating Mossadegh as intemperate, unstable, and or otherwise unreliable as an ally in the Cold War. But the real motivation was for hijacking Iran's history was Mossadegh's move to nationalize Western-controlled oil assets in Iran. According to the document, part of an internal CIA report, quote, the target, this is from the CIA, quote, the target of this policy of desperation, Mossadegh, was neither a madman nor an emotional bundle of senility, as he was often pictured in the foreign press. However, he had become so committed to the ideals of nationalism, he did things that could not have conceivably helped his people, even the best and most altruistic of worlds. In refusing to bargain, except on his own uncompromising terms with the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, that's British Petroleum, he was in effect defying the professional politicians of the British government. These leaders believed, with good reason, that cheap oil for Britain and high profits for the company were vital to their national interest. End quote. There you have it. The smoking gun declaration of the true intent to to preserve high profits and cheap oil that cuts through all of the official propaganda justifying not only the sorry attempt to prevent Iranian nationalists from gaining control over their own prized resources, but subsequent blood-for-oil adventures like Iran, Kuwait, I should say, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So take it from there and tell us about this man who your father was good friends with and his personal lawyer. Tell us about who he was, what he did, and what happened when he was thrown out of power by the United States and in England, and how that impacts Iran today.
Yes. Thank you for having me on your show. There are a lot of answers to the statement that you read. First of all, I have to say that I have written a lot of articles about Dr. Mossadegh, not just because my father was his personal attorney and mayor of Tehran during his premiership, but because the more I read about him and the more I investigated his own writings, I came to the conclusion that he was a man that could have had it all. And he, you know, as I wrote in my article, he came from the previous royal family of the Qajars, which was the previous family dynasty to the Pahlavis. And he was actually his mother was a princess. But he took a different route. And he, when he went abroad and he was educated in Switzerland and in France, he came with the notion that he came back to Iran with the notion that he wanted to bring reform and use the constitutional revolution, which was of 1906, and implement and practice what the constitutional revolution was all about, which was really a democratic agenda for Iran in 1906, which is, you know, a long time ago. And he was very much enlightened, and he was a man of as I said, he came from the nobility, but he actually went against that nobility. His own family was the Qajar family, who the dynasty, and he went against them with his ideas and what he had envisioned for Iran, which was, democracy. And I grew up in that kind of atmosphere, with my father being, of course, a friend, but Mossadegh was his mentor in a way, and so we grew up in an environment where there was always talk of Mossadegh and pictures of him everywhere. But it was more than that. It's my own studies of his writing, of this man who had everything and basically gave up everything for the betterment of his society. There is a lot of talk right now about the new documents. The new documents by the CIA that for the first time they have admitted that they actually had a role in the coup d'etat of 1953. I don't think these are very new. I think that for the longest time, scholars of Iran, scholars of especially American scholars, European scholars, Iranians, they have studied Iran and that period immensely. There are so many books and articles that I think more work has been written about that period than any other time of period during Iranian history, because not only are Americans interested and American scholars interested, but also it's sort of with us Iranians and Iranian Americans. When we talk about Mossadegh and the 1953 coup, we sort of get very sad, because we always say we had an elected government, a democratically elected government, and we lost it. We lost it because foreign forces intervened, and in the words of a woman who was working at the State Department in Iran, at the Foreign Ministry in Iran, telling a very high-level U.S. State Department person that you took Mossadegh from us. And I think that really resonates with many Iranians, because we had a man who was absolutely incorruptible. You know, in Iran, unfortunately, a lot of people were bought with U.S. dollars or British pounds. This was a man who nobody could buy. And that's why they went after him, you know, with all kinds of propaganda against him. For example, he's a Jew. He's a, I mean, that is supposed to be a negative connotation about Mossadegh. You know, in the Iranian newspapers, he's, you know, he's a demagogue. He's, you know, all kinds of very terrible adjectives. And of course, the CIA operatives had a role in it. But I want to emphasize on this, and I think that this is very important. Yes, now we have sort of new documents, where I think they're not necessarily new documents. They've been there. In 2000, the New York Times published, you know, basically the CIA account that the CIA had a role. And if we look at the last 10 years, both the Obama administration and Madeleine Albright, they have said that, yes, we apologize to the Iranian people for interfering in their, you know, in their affairs. So basically, the admission is there. So I don't think there's any really anything new. It's just maybe the black lines or what was blackened on the CIA report is now there. But in my opinion, and I want to really emphasize on this for your listeners, that I do believe that the CIA had an important role in the coup d'etat of 1953, but I think the push came from the British, because the British were going to lose big time in Iran. And not only Mossadegh wanted to nationalize the Iranian oil, but also he went after kicking the British personnel from the embassy, because they were, a lot of them were agents, and a lot of them were interfering in daily Iranian affairs. And so I think that the U.S. administration and the U.S. State Department was highly influenced by the British Foreign Office and by the British government.
I agree. By the way, Mossadegh was also considered the Persian Gandhi.
Yes.
He was an advocate of nonviolence and peaceful means to achieve social and political goals. And since your father was not only Mossadegh's personal attorney, but also a close friend and colleague in the National Front before and after his short leadership, then you had a chance to become aware of this man's character in person. But there's the second part of this issue, and here's what we have to focus on. The Shah of Iran was installed when Mossadegh was taken out of power. And then you had corruption, you had pro-Western globalization in Iran, and you had prisons filled with dissenters, you had torture, you had murder, you had a police state, all under the control of the CIA and British intelligence, M16, but also foreign corporations. Talk about what it was like under the Shah of Iran and what he did to make sure there was no dissent, no democratic movements, no freedom of the press, nothing.
Right. Well, if you allow me, I would like to sort of talk about talk about three different issues here. One is that when we talk about Mossadegh as a man who would not use violence against his own people, much like Gandhi and much like Mandela, the day before the 19th of August, which is the day of the coup d'etat, people went to him, the Tudeh party, which was the Communist Party of Iran and allied with the Soviet Union. They went to him, head of the tribes in Iran, who were very much in support of Mossadegh, especially the Qashqai tribe, which is they had arms and they had lots of men. They went to Mossadegh and they told him, and I actually quote my father on this in his memoirs, which will be published very soon. Please give us arms and let us defend you and let us, thwart the coup d'etat. And he said, you know, cut the arms of a man, of a prime minister who would give arms to anybody to shoot at people. And I think that is a very important statement by Mossadegh. Mossadegh could have stayed in power if he were for violence, if he were not a man of law. He believed truly in the use of parliamentary methods in order to get his message across, and that is when he basically decided that he's going to surrender to the authorities and he will not use violence as a means to stay in power. And I think that's very, very important.
I also do, because they had planned on killing him. So
yes, of course, on several occasions. And he was, he was an old man, but he was a very smart man, a smart politician.
But
And the second issue, yes, I'm sorry, we're sort of, I think you asked me about the...
Fariba, we need to know about the Shah, because the Shah replaced the democratic elected government, and then the Ayatollah replaced the Shah.
Right.
And then
right.
we end up where we're at, and American
exactly.
history and journalists don't look back the fact that we caused the crisis in Iran today. We're the architects of it.
Yes.
So
yes.
brief. We don't have a lot of time, so would you briefly summarize what happened under the Shah, and then what the status is today?
Yes. The Shah actually at the beginning worked with Mossadegh because Mossadegh was very popular. But the Shah was also a very weak leader in many ways. He was not a very decisive person. But what happened was that Mossadegh wanted to have a very cordial and good relations with the U.S. And he didn't want to become just an arm purchaser, where actually after his downfall, Iran became the major arm purchaser in the Middle East from the U.S. And that is something that we should not forget. Iran basically bought F-16s and F-15s and everything else from the U.S. So Mossadegh was all about reform and making changes within his society for the betterment of his countrymen and women. Where when the Shah... And this is also another aspect of the coup d'etat, which I would like to talk about, is that when Mossadegh was overthrown, well, who comes to power? Well, Colonel Zahedi comes to power, who was basically interned by the British for being a pro-Nazi sympathizer. So this is the guy who takes the place of Mossadegh, and of course the Shah, who did not trust Zahedi, dismisses him after a while. But then, we have the Shah, and we have an oppressive society where, in many ways, Iran under the Shah was a dictatorship. Savak, the notorious secret police, was created. There were political prisoners. Many leftist liberals were, including my father, imprisoned. My father was imprisoned 6 times, and the Shah had the secret police, and basically there was censorship of the press. Whereas during the 2 years that Mossadegh was prime minister, they came to him and said, prime minister, there are all these articles against you. He said, that is the meaning of free press. Let them criticize me, but I believe in freedom of press. Well, during the Shah, all of that was abolished. No gathering, no freedom of press, nothing. So, yes, we had political prisoners. There were executions. There were, murders. There was torture. You know, the Savak was basically trained under the CIA and some say under the Mossad. So we have a full, full dictatorship. In terms of, I have to make this distinction because it's very important for your listeners. The dictatorship was the dictatorship of taking away people's political rights. But in many ways, in terms of basic rights, where a woman could dress the way they wanted, that was free in Iran. That existed in Iran. Whereas today, unfortunately, after the revolution in Iran, I do not like to use the Islamic revolution because I think that the revolution was the revolution of the people and they hijacked it, the Islamists hijacked it. But we had freedom, basic personal freedoms, but no political freedom, definitely not under the Shah. And, of course, today we have neither.
Okay, well, we're out of time. I'm sorry that we don't have more time to explore this because you have a rich background, but I'm going to invite you back as a part of our one-hour special on the Progressive Commentary Hour so we can know more about your father and the freedom movement during that period of time of the Shah and what you believe are the chances that a younger generation in Iran will once again go to the streets and force the type of political freedom that has been absent for so long. Thank you very much for being with us today. My guest from Germany, Fariba Amini, and she is the journalist who writes on Iranian and human and women rights. And her father was the personal attorney and close friend of Mohammad Mossadegh. And we thank her for being with us. I'm out of time. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Very nice show. Very informative. Today, of course, it's open forum. And the conversation goes where people want to drive it.
Great. Utrice Lead, right now, please stay with us.